Welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Trapper Rudden. He'll be answering your most important questions on fly fishing in Micronesia, a fly fishing adventure. This show will be 90 minutes in length, and we're broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Trapper a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And while you're there, make sure you sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Just fill in your name and email address in the form on our homepage, and we'll keep you informed. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website within 24 hours after the show ends. So if you have to leave early, you can return to our website at your convenience and listen to the broadcast at any time. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted and is the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of this program cannot be distributed or sold in any form. When we return, we'll be talking with Trapper Rudd about fly fishing Micronesia, a fly fishing adventure. Tonight's show is sponsored by Rail Riders. Why is Rail Riders adventure clothing fast becoming the favorite of fly fishing enthusiasts worldwide? Simple answer, because they expect their clothing to always be up to the task. Rail Riders delivers in a big, satisfying way. Its award-winning collection of technical apparel is tough, quick-drying, lightweight, and comfortable. Ideal for freshwater or salt, whether it's chasing steelhead on an uncrowded river or hunting elusive bonefish along warm flats, Rail Riders will make the catch of the day even more enjoyable. Rail Riders make the toughest clothes on the planet. Here's a special offer for your first purchase. Use code RRAF, that's RRAF, when checking out on their website or over the phone and get 15% off your first order. So go to railriders.com now. That's www.railriders.com or call them at 1-800-437-3794. That's 1-800-437-3794 and take advantage of this special offer today. Before we introduce Trapper, we'd like to let you know about the great gifts we have to give away tonight. On our drawing tonight, we'll be giving away a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a one-year subscription to Fly Fusion magazine. So you have two chances to win in our drawing. Now, if you haven't registered yet for the drawing, you can do so now. Just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and look for the link under Trapper's section that says, click here to register for our drawing. Click on that link and fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. We'll also be giving away a pair of Rail Riders Extreme Adventure Pants, the toughest pair of fly fishing pants on the market. Lightweight, synthetic with super tough reinforced knees, good pocket design, and articulated knees. Velcro and elastic cuffs are invaluable for staying put under waders, and they also prove to be the best wading pants on the market. So here's how you can win. You must be the first person to answer the question we ask at the end of the show, and the question will be something that Trapper and I talk about during the show. You must submit your answer along with your name and location in the text box on our homepage, and the first person to do that correctly will win that pair of Rail Riders Extreme Adventure Pants. Our guest tonight is Trapper Rudd. Trapper Rudd has a peculiar quirk in his genetic code that certainly must be a rarity in the human species. This genetic rarity most likely provides Trapper with the ability to think like a fish. Trapper says, I don't see the fish so much as I feel them. Trapper has fished every continent on our planet save Antarctica, and he is the only known angler to have ever fished the imperial koi ponds of the Emperor of Japan. But upon his discovery, the imperial palace guards were summoned, but he was later released with a smile and just asked never to return again. A typical month for Trapper might see him roaming the waters of the Zambezi River in Mozambique one week, jetting off to New Zealand for trout the next week, and then literally days later prowling the flats of Micronesia searching for giant trevally. His videos on YouTube have sparked much praise in industry from insiders for their raw, humorous, and edgy gorilla style. Born in California and raised in the cold rivers of Colorado, Trapper always struggled with his inner salt. Trapper was a trout hunter throughout his childhood, exploring rivers at upper altitudes of Colorado and eventually guiding others in the 1990s. Trapper was the owner of the Cutthroat Anglers in Silverthorne, Colorado from 1999 to 2010. And Trapper and his family then moved to Bonita Springs, Florida, where the salt hangs in the air. So Trapper is currently a partner in Sporting Life Adventure Travel, a fly fishing destination company that specializes in unique angling destinations and exceptional client relations. He has been featured on numerous television shows, including In Search of Fly Water, Legends of Rod and Reel, Backroads with Ron and Raven, and Eco Fishing Adventures. Trapper also contributes many articles to Fly Fish America as contributing editor, and he is one of the few on the G. Loomis Elite Pro staff and also fishes for Scientific Anglers. He also consults and fishes for Freedom Hawk Kayaks. Well, Trapper, thanks for joining us tonight on Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
Well, it's my pleasure, Roger. I hope I can get a clear signal all the way from down here to you.
Well, we know you'll have to fill us in because I know you just had a little mini-adventure tonight just getting to a cell phone tower, right?
Yeah, I'm currently on kind of a quasi-assignment. I don't know if they're ever really official assignments, but I'm down in the extreme southern end of the Mexican Yucatan, literally at the end of the road, kind of based out of a village called Ixcalac, which is just above the Belize border. And I was out fishing today, exploring some bonefish flats and some permit flats on the over on the west side of this beautiful point of land. And I got off the water, and I thankfully found a hot shower. And I'm staying right now at Costa de Cocos in Ixcalac, which is just a phenomenal, you know, fly fishing and dive resort. And their generosity is just incredible. They're taking care of the whole crew, and we're just having a great time, and they've made it very, very easy for us. But the interesting thing was, you know, there's no cell service there. So I had to quick jump in the vehicle and drive through the Mexican mangrove lowlands here. It's kind of just miles and miles and miles of marshland. And, you know, I was dodging, you know, some interesting rodents and wild pigs and whatnot just to get here. It's been dark for a couple of hours. And I'm now kind of sitting literally at a gas station near Mahahual with about the only place I could find that has a great cell signal. So I just want to say to your listeners, you know, thank you for tuning in to Roger's show. And if, you know, this Mexican technology can hold out, we're going to have a great program. And if for some reason it fails, hang in there, go grab a slice of pizza and a cold beer or something, and I'll get right back on it as soon as humanly possible.
Okay. Well, we'll see how far we go, but we appreciate all your efforts to make the show tonight. And, hey, you know, I mean, if an adventure doing the show wasn't part of it, then, you know, how could we really talk about a fly fishing adventure to Micronesia? You know, I mean, it's all an adventure. So
that's right. And every adventure has its own flavor. So
there we go. Well, let's talk about Micronesia. Our first question came in from Chris Gadson in Ontario, Canada, and he said, Trapper, what made you choose Micronesia as a fly fishing destination?
I think the fact that really, you know, when you ask people, you know, have you ever heard of Micronesia? Nobody ever has. And I think that right there was kind of, you know, a bell going off saying, hey, you know, if nobody really knows where this country is, you know, it's probably got some fish and it sounds interesting. It might, you know, people might be interested in hearing about it. And that's really kind of, I think, the attraction is finding these places that are on the map, have always been on the map, but yet are very unknown. And I think that's, you know, that was the interesting thing. Plus the fact that it's, you know, it's located just north of the equator. It's kind of technically not the South Pacific, but it's really not the North Pacific. It's kind of more, you know, closer to the, I guess, the southern North Pacific. But just looking at it on Google Earth, which is where I do a lot of my homework, just had a very tantalizing appeal. So that was really kind of the reason to go. And, you know, it was after, you know, spending hours and hours exploring, you know, the world via the Internet and Google Earth, you know, you can kind of, you know, after years of doing this, you start to develop some skills and you realize, you know, here's an island that has some unique geologic features. And, you know, so I was looking at that, and then there's other tricks that I have up my sleeve where it's kind of like being a detective. And there's certain websites where you can get information, government information and whatnot, say on import and export of goods, and especially like fish, if they're exporting fish, And it kind of tells you right there that, you know, you might see some species on that list that, that would be targetable with a fly rod and make for some exciting sport. So, you know, you start piecing together these big pieces of the puzzle, and that's really kind of how I end up choosing these destinations. And, you know, some of the stuff has just kind of been done over and over and over. So I think, you know, going to destinations where people have never really heard of it, you know, it helps promote, you know, some economic income for the island or the, in this case, or the community, and it makes for a good story. And that's really, you know, part of fly fishing is not only the joy of being out there, but sharing it with your friends and having a great memory and being able to tell a wonderful story about it.
Right, right. Well, before we talk specifically about Micronesia and where it's at and so forth, if anybody out there is on their computers right now, you can get a clear picture of this, and it'll probably be good reference for what Trapper will tell us here in a few minutes. But if you just go out to Google and then click on Maps, and then just type in Micronesia. And so go to Google Maps, Micronesia, and then you can kind of zoom in there to that part of the world. There's a vast array of islands there, and I'm sure Trapper will direct us to where he ended up there. But do that again. Go to Google and then go to Maps. It should be in the top left corner, Google Maps, and then Micronesia, M-I-C-R-O-N-E-S-I-A, M-I-C-R-O-N-E-S-I-A. And then you'll have something to look at while we're talking. So, okay, so you did your research, you poked around, Micronesia, you know, started looking interesting to you. Was the purpose of the trip just to have a good time, or did you have other any commercial aspects of it?
Yeah, it really was. I mean, you know, my partner Paul Hansen and I in Sporting Life Adventure Travel, we kind of always look at destinations as with the possibility of being able to assist people with going there and fishing and having a wonderful, you know, destination fly fishing place to go to. And I think that's part of it. But the other part of it really is truly just, you know, sheer unbridled adventure. And that's really, I think, one of the most important things. It's kind of like if you're back home in Colorado and you're walking up a river and you turn the corner around that river and you see someone standing there, it kind of just detracts a little bit from your moment of discovery of being on this river and what's around the next bend. So when you pick a place like Micronesia, you know, you pretty much know you're going to have, you know, some solitary flats or blue water or whatever, you know, to fish. And I think that's really kind of important. So, you know, I think people find that attractive.
So do you think it has potential as a, you know, exotic destination that you might promote?
It really does. It really does. We were very fortunate. I made some contacts with a lovely couple from Australia that run a beautiful dive resort, is really what it is, because fly fishing, they looked at us like we had three heads, you know, when we showed up with all this gear and we're out there waving these 9-foot sticks around, and, you know, they just don't fish like that, and they're not really aware of it. They're very westernized, but, you know, it's still very new to them, and they were gracious enough to host us and bring us down. And just, you know, for your listeners also, if you're looking at Micronesia, or if you're familiar with Micronesia, we were in particular on the island of Kosh Rai, and it's spelled kind of funny, and the pronunciation is different, but it's K-O-S-R-A-E, and it's pronounced Kosh Rai, and it is kind of, in the Federated States of Micronesia, it is the last island in the chain. So once again, you know, here's this kind of theme going, you know, here I am sitting at the end of the road in Mexico, literally, and here I was in the end of the islands over there. So there's something going on there. I'm not sure what that is. But that's in particular the island that we were on. And we have to go back, actually, and do some more research on some other atolls in the area. But, you know, Kosh Rai is so isolated, if you will. You know, they have their own languages. Like you have, you know, the island of Kosh Rai, and let's say you have Yap further up the chain, and then you have Pinglop and Ponape, and all these islands, even though they're kind of under the same flag, the Federated States of Micronesia, each island has its own language. So, for example, if the locals from Kosh Rai went to Yap, they wouldn't necessarily understand them. It's not like you know, versions of Spanish, like Castilian Spanish or Latin American Spanish or Portuguese, where they're so similar that you can kind of get through. They're very radically different, and that's also a very unique feature of this area.
I'm out there now, Trapper, trying to find this island you were at, and it's not popping out at me. When you say the last island, are we talking about past New Guinea, out towards the Solomons, or...
Yes, exactly.
That?
I apologize. I don't have a computer sitting in front of me, so it's a little difficult for me to describe, but it's very tiny. It's a very tiny island, and... You know, I think if anything, you'd probably have to, you know, be on Google Earth and literally type in Kosrae, Micronesia, and then you could probably get it to zoom in on the area. But, you know, it's, I think it's, you know, only around, you know, 42 square kilometers. So it's a tiny dot, you know, in the middle of the ocean.
How do you spell it again?
Kosrae. And it's a huge country. I mean, it's kind of like Indonesia, you know, in essence that, you know, really the nearest island can be 400 miles away.
Yeah, it has an airstrip, it says here.
Huh. Yes, it does. And continental Micronesia flies there on a regular schedule, which is very interesting in itself. It's kind of an island-hopping tour, their flight route. And that's how, you know, we got there through the, you know, the folks at Continental Micronesia took good care of us and helped sponsor part of our expedition there.
Well, you're not kidding. It's a small island. If I wouldn't have typed that in, we would have never found it.
Yeah.
So, folks, if in a general direction, it's between Papua New Guinea and the Marshall Islands. So it's a little dot way out there. But if you do type in Google Maps, Kosrae, and Micronesia, then it will zoom you in, and then you have to zoom out to see where that is. Okay, that's not at all where I thought it was going to be.
So,
that's out in the middle of nowhere for sure.
So how you really get there is you know, let's say wherever you come from in the States. For me, it was coming from Florida all the way across the country to Los Angeles, and then you fly from Los Angeles to Honolulu in Hawaii, and then you fly from Hawaii to Majuro, which is in the Marshall Islands, basically, and then you fly to Kwajalein Atoll, which is, you know, very famous from the World War II era, and a lot of, you know, veterans, you know, would certainly recognize the name of that island, and then you stop, and then from Kwajalein, you fly into Kosrae, and then it continues on to Yap and Guam and whatnot way up the chain, but it's a...
How many hours was that?
Oh, God, I think...
A couple days?
Yeah, well, it was, you know, 11,000 miles, you know, to fly, and I think it was about 38 hours of travel time. You know, you stop in each island on the way, and which is good for us because we get to do a little quick research while we're there for, you know, to put in the bank for the future, so...
So did you spend the whole time on this Kosrae island?
Yes, yeah. You know, the interesting thing about a place like Kosrae in Micronesia is there's a tremendous, and I don't mean this to sound deleterious in any fashion towards the island or its inhabitants, but there's a kind of a, there's three different yeses that you can receive as an answer. And one is yes, yes, and one is yes, maybe, and then the other is yes, no. So when you ask certain questions, and they say yes, you never know which one it really is. You know, and they're such wonderful people that, you know, that they just don't ever want to, you know, say no to you, I guess is really what it boils down to. So, you know, so when we asked about going there and fishing and what kind of species they had, you know, do you have bonefish, do you have tarpon, you know, do you have giant trevally? Well, the answers were always yes. So, and then it's, I guess, up to you to decide which yes it is. Yes, no, yes, maybe, or yes, yes.
So now, on the island, when I've blown this up, was there a particular place? I noticed there's several names there. Is there a name for where you were at on the island?
Yeah, we were below Tafensock, it's pronounced.
Yeah, that's on here at the top of the island.
And down by Tafool, and you'll see... Oh, geez, I'm drawing a blank on the island. I think it's Leilu
or something.
Leilua. We were just inside. See that big blue hole on that flat? That's right where the resort is positioned, and we could go out and fly fish that flat in the morning prior to heading out on our day and fish that blue hole, and I actually caught some beautiful blue trevally out of that. And if any of the, you know, the folks listening tonight have ever seen a picture or actually had the good fortune to catch a blue trevally, to me, they're one of my most favorite fish in the world because the color of that blue as they come out of the water when they're all lit up is just absolutely impossible to find in nature other than on a blue trevally. It is absolutely stunning. It's stunning, and the pictures never do it justice.
Well, we need to take a quick break here, Trapper, so hang tight. We'll be right back, and we'll be talking with you more about fly fishing in Micronesia. Captain Bob Jaspers of Flats Time Charters will introduce you to the Mosquito Lagoon, Indian River, and No Motor Zone of the Banana River on the east coast of Central Florida. Only a short drive from Orlando, you will sight fish for big redfish, spotted sea trout, and black drum, as well as a seasonal snook or tarpon. Captain Bob is a lifetime resident of the area and chosen his knowledge of the local fish, flora, and fauna. Call Flats Time Charters now and arrange your next memorable adventure. You can reach Captain Bob Jaspers at 321-631-4051. That's 321-631-4051. Or go to their website at flatstime.com. That's FLATSTIME.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Trapper Rudd about fly fishing in Micronesia, a fly fishing adventure. If you'd like to ask Trapper a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com. And use that Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Well, Trapper, we always ask our guests, you know, what's going on in their fly fishing world. So why don't you just take a minute and tell us about your business, your website, and what you do, you know, when you're not out adventuring.
I'd love to. You know, before I forget, I want to give a quick shameless shout-out to my wife and children in Florida, and just wanted to say Merry Christmas, and I will be home soon, so fear not. And,
there you go.
So take advantage of this wonderful connection we have tonight.
There you go.
Well, just a little bit of history. I was the owner of a fly shop up in Silverthorne, Colorado, and my wife is from Naples, Florida. And it was, you know, it's kind of eternal winter up there. I mean, it's a beautiful place. You know it well. And, you know, it was just kind of time to make a change, and we, you know, had moved to Florida, and I was commuting back and forth, and kind of the strain on the family and the commuting and all the international travel that I do was just, you know, it was weary, you know, wearing us down a little bit. So we ended up in Florida full time. You know, I turned over the shop earlier this year and had a side company with my partner Paul Hansen called Sporting Life Adventure Travel, and we've always, you know, booked some clients of ours and others into, you know, well-known fly fishing destinations around the globe, and it's real easy to find. It's www.sportinglifetravel.com. And, you know, we're a young company, but we certainly have just a mad amount of knowledge when it comes to destinations and taking care of people, and it was a good fit for us both. And Paul's been in the fly fishing industry for a long, long time, as I have myself. And we really just love, you know, the interaction of clients, you know, with us. And it's a good feeling, you know, to send people on a trip they've really been wanting to do. And because the cool thing about it is, you know, it was kind of like having the fly shop. You know, when people walk in the door, they're always in a good mood because they're going fishing, right? So it's pretty uncommon to have somebody in a sour mood. So when the phone rings, you know, when somebody wants to go fishing somewhere, it's a pretty easy phone call to receive because you get to talk about fishing, and then you get to see the results of and the successes and sharing their successes when they come back from their trip. So that, I think that's the real neat, attractive part of it, you know, is just getting to share the experience with the people through their stories and their photographs and their recommendations to friends and whatnot. So that's what I do when I'm actually, you know, off the water, which is,
of course, that's, you know, all research, so tax-deductible research, right?
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah, we feel for you, Trapper. Yeah, we're all crying in our beers here right now, so.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, tough life.
I've heard that a lot. I had one of our friends said, you know, said my job is better than your vacation. You know, and that's what he's always saying. So it's kind of funny. It's a good job.
Well, good. Well, thanks for sharing that with us. Well, we've got some more questions, and some of them to do about, again, just finding this place. Martin Coleman in Lawrence, Kansas asks, how do you go about setting up a trip to a destination like Micronesia or other countries with fish and fishing techniques you are unfamiliar with? So you told us about your research. You know, did you then contact people on this island, or did you go there blindly, or what?
Yeah, no, I contacted Doug and Sally at the Kashrai Nautilus Resort, and they had a great operation. And I think like many destination places that might specialize in one thing, you know, they're always looking to kind of branch out. And Kashrai in itself is very unaccustomed to tourism. I mean, really, you know, as Continental is the only airline that flies in there. They come in, I think, 5 times a week, and that's it. And a lot of the people that are traveling through there actually are visiting the island as a layover, you know, on their way to other destinations in the South Pacific and whatnot. So, or they're there on dive trips, but certainly nobody goes there to fly fish. So we're trying to change that, you know, and give some exposure to new destinations, try new things, try new species. And really what goes into it is making those contacts. So, you know, first, like we had talked about, you start with your research and you kind of get a comfortable level with, you know, population based on the size and the surrounding water. And then you start making those contacts and saying, hey, you know, we got this opportunity to go here. You know, we got a hold of the, you know, the Ministry of Tourism or whatnot and said we'd like to, you know, help you guys promote some tourism for your country. And really it's kind of creating these little, Paul and I like to call them economic incubators, you know, for the islands and the destinations that we visit, you know, and help maybe promote, you know, some small villages or whatever. So, you know, there is kind of an altruistic humanitarian effort that goes into a little bit as well. But, you know, more so it's, you know, let's get some people out and think about some different kinds, different places to fish and new species. And so what you do is you continue to move on, you know, down this kind of chain of events to get there. So, you know, we were fortunate to have some wonderful sponsors like Scientific Anglers, you know, were really, really good to us and really, you know, helped us with a lot of promotional material and fly gear to use, you know, down there, and buffs as well. You know, buffs is, you know, those really great neck gaiters that you can kind of pull up over your head and time in a, you know, a million different fashionable ways to wear it, you know, for sun protection. And so these guys, you know, really went to great effort, you know, to help us, you know, have a successful trip. And without, you know, folks like that and Continental, you know, Micronesia and Kashrai Nautilus Resort, you know, these kind of things can't be done. So, you know, I think if you present it in the right light, you know, with enough information and it's apparent that you've done your homework, you know, you're going to have a successful trip.
Now, did you go there with the intent of targeting specific species of fish, or?
Yeah,
was it more of a destination?
Yeah, you know, I fell victim to the yes, maybe, I think is what it would have been. You know, when in the conversation with the folks on the island, it was evident that they had tarpon, and I'd seen pictures of tarpon. And so that was exciting, you know, to find tarpon in that kind of area was, I thought, was very unusual. Well, you know, little did I know, you know, it turned out to be Indo-Pacific tarpon, which that particular species of tarpon tend to run very small. So a large one, you know, might be, you know, 60 or 70 centimeters, you know, as opposed to the Atlantic tarpon we get around, you know, the United States, if you will, in Florida, you know, where they can be 120 pounds or better, you know, and of all kinds of sizes. So, you know, really we were hoping to find, you know, a new frontier, so to speak, for, you know, a potential tarpon fishery, a potential bone fishery. You know, if they have bonefish in Hawaii, you know, for example, gigantic bonefish, it kind of stands to reason that in that band of temperature zone that runs around the middle of the earth, you know, that bonefish could certainly be present there. So, you know, a lot of communication goes back and forth, and you think you got it nailed down. Sometimes you don't exactly hit it right, but you also end up then with the alternate species to back up your plan. And in our case, we were going to target giant trevally and then some of the pelagic species. But really, you know, we were hoping to find kind of tarpon and bonefish and have the story kind of evolve around that. But as it turns out, those two were really not available, so we shift gears, and then we go into the inshore species and alternative flat species like bluefin trevally and, you know, other like golden trevally or Indo-Pacific permit or GTs, you know, giant trevally. So that's really, you know, and just looking at the topography and the geology of that area, you know that you're going to have some great inshore fishing with all the fringe reef that runs around these islands. And for example, and then how it drops off immediately into thousands of, you know, feet of water. Literally within, you know, sight of land, you can be in thousands of feet of water.
Yeah, the deep blue, huh? The deep blue.
Yeah.
One question was about, and you said you were staying at this resort. So were the accommodations there pretty nice? I mean, typical
resort
accommodation?
Yeah, very nice. You know, we had clean, clean, comfortable rooms, excellent food. I mean, the food was just, you know, wonderful, and lots of fresh seafood, as you can imagine. And they had a pool, and, you know, it was kind of quite the departure, you know, from a lot of the places I stay, which, you know, would be, you know, less than desirable for most people. But, you know, this place, we felt quite pampered. It was really nice. You know, they're so gracious. They said, here's our pickup truck, you know. And here's a cool little side story. You know, they drive on the right-hand side of the road like we do in the United States, but majority of the vehicles over there have right-hand drive. So it was a very odd sensation. I'm certainly comfortable driving on the left-hand side of the road, say, like you would in New Zealand, with the steering wheel on the right-hand side, but to be on the right-hand side of the road with a right hand, I felt like I was delivering the mail every time I went.
Well, you had good practice.
Yeah.
We had a couple of questions, and it sounds like you may not be able to help these guys out, but one was Ewald in Idaho was asking about, he's traveling Palau in February, and he's going to mainly do diving. But he says he doesn't travel without a fly rod. He'd like to know what you could tell him about fly fishing opportunities in that area. Do you know anything about Palau, or can you give
him? Yeah, sure. Thanks for the question. That's a really cool one. We, you know, we didn't have the time to visit it, you know, unfortunately. We were hoping to hit another island or two while we were there. It just worked out with rain and other environmental factors that we kind of had to spend as much time as we could in Kashrai. But we did speak with a lot of people that were traveling from Palau, for example. You know, we'd be having dinner and, you know, you kind of, by default, I think, see other travelers and you strike up a conversation. We talked about Palau and we end up getting some contact information from guys in the military, for example, or whatever, from Kwajalein. Hey, I got a buddy that lives on Palau, and call him, you know, or email him and get some info. So I would say if he's going to Palau, and you are going to Palau, certainly take your fly rod. You may not find great flats fishing, and I haven't looked at Palau in a little while, but certainly there's probably going to be some decent, if not really good, inshore fishing. And inshore fishing, by that, what I kind of consider inshore fishing is if you're on the flat, looking at the reef, just outside that reef is kind of where you would approach it. Now, it's usually not a waitable option, but it's an option that, you know, if you have a local there and you got some extra dough, you know, and he wants to earn some extra dough, you can pay him a little bit, maybe, or one of the local fishermen. That's what we use, a lot of the local guys, and have them take us out, you know, and give them a kind of a day from the grind of their, you know, catching fish and fly them, you know, some money and make it worth their while, and then say, here's what we need, you know, and then these guys can take us out and position us up close to the reef, and that's where you're going to find your giant trevally and other trevallies and, you know, snappers and some really amazing species, too. Stuff that's quite, you know, unusual for us in the western, you know, part of the world. So it's
right.
Well, I wouldn't hesitate one bit to go to Palau and try it over there. I would say probably he's going to want to take a 9-weight and a 10-weight at a minimum and maybe even an 11 or a 12, you know, because chances are, you know, you're going to be fishing inshore, but you'll probably have a whole gaggle of tuna busting up, you know, right behind you, in which case you're going to want to have something a little bit heavier to tackle those guys.
Okay. Good, good, good tips for you all. Sure, you'll appreciate that. The other one was from Nick in London, and he says his father just moved to Singapore, and his father says there's no decent fly fishing in that region. And he wants to know if you know anything about fly fishing in that part of Micronesia.
Well, yeah, it's a whole different part of the world. I really don't think, I don't know really anything about Singapore.
Okay, that's fine. Yep. That's fine.
Yeah, I wish I did.
Well, you gave a lot of tips on how to research, and maybe Nick can do some research for his dad there and see what he can turn up and maybe find some new destinations. Another question from Walter Dinkins in North Carolina. He says he was over in Guam in 94 through 96, and he traveled by ship through all the Micronesia Islands. But his main question was about overfishing with gill netting techniques. How did you find a lot of overfishing or fishing at all here in Cus Rai?
Well, Walter sounds like a pretty astute fellow. Sounds like I need to be talking to him. If he's been through all those islands on a ship, he's probably got just scads of info that'd be beneficial.
I'll hook you two guys up together. So.
Yeah, well, that'd be wonderful. I'd love to have a chance to speak with him. And, you know, this is one of those weird circumstances where you don't want to, you kind of don't want to really tell what you found. You know, I think the negative part of the experience was the fact that, you know, there probably were bonefish in Micronesia at one time. I would certainly think they were. They were probably all eaten generations ago. But there's those alternate species that I spoke of earlier. We did see plenty of gill netting. And here's a, for your listeners, Raj, I made a video of this, kind of a quick, really, really cool video called Island of the Sleeping Lady. And you can go on to the Trapper Rudd channel on YouTube or the Sporting Life. No, I'm sorry. It's only, it was kind of a sneak peek for everybody. It's been so popular, I've kind of just haven't touched it much lately. But if you go on to YouTube and you search Island of the Sleeping Lady or my name, Trapper Rudd, or go on to the Trapper Rudd channel, you can watch this video and it'll give you a very good sense of what it's like over there. And in the video, there's a short segment where I was out walking the flat one morning by that giant blue hole and stumbled up on a shark that had been caught in a gill net that had rolled up on the reef. And it was, you know, it was a very somber moment. And the fisherman, you know, I think whose net it was the one that actually shot the video. I asked him, I said, hey, would you mind, you know, holding this and pointing it in my direction while I kind of chronicle this event? So, you know, it's their style of fishing, and there's a lot of sustenance fishing that goes on, and I certainly can't fault anybody for that. You know, if you're trying to feed a family and make a living, that's what you do. Certainly there's opportunities for education, you know, to help them, you know, understand conservation and such. But so, yes, you know, Walter, we did find some gill netting, but the cool thing about the island, the upside is, you know, and they eat just about every kind of fish that you can imagine. I mean, for aquarium hobbyists or, you know, guys that keep saltwater tanks and stuff, a lot of those coral fish that you would find on the reefs are often in the frying pan in these islands, you know, down there. Not just isolated to Micronesia, but just about anywhere. You know, when we were in Indonesia, we saw the same thing, and I think it happens all through the South Pacific and everywhere you go. But, you know, it was, you know, I kind of lost my train of thought there for the moment, but
are you talking about the positive aspects?
Yeah, well, the positive aspect was, thank you, was the fact that the guys that are out there in the pongas every day catching bonita and yellowfin and other species, they're doing it very, very ecologically sound. They're doing it with hook and line, and they're not using nets, and so they hand line these massive tuna in, or the small bonita, so they're very light, you know, on the resource, which was wonderful to see. You know, I think some of the other countries that are well known for their seafood, you know, are certainly in the area with their bigger boats. outside the international lines of, you know, roughly 12 miles, or you know, I think in Micronesia it was right around 12 miles. And they're certainly out there doing some damage, but the guys on the island themselves, the fishermen, were practicing some pretty dang strong conservation skills on their fishery. It was really cool to see.
Yeah, good. We need to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll be talking more with Trapper Rudd about fly fishing in Micronesia. Our approach is simple, education. Fly Fusion is unique when it comes to fly fishing magazines. It is one of only a few magazines in North America that focuses on instruction and education. In Fly Fusion, we've covered subjects like short line nymphing, tactics for tough days, stillwater fly patterns, dry fly fishing for fussy trout, and a host of other interesting and educational topics. Visit our website today at www.flyfusionmag.com. That's flyfusionmag.com. And start your subscription to Fly Fusion today so that you can learn all you need to know about fly fishing. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Trapper Rudd about fly fishing in Micronesia. If you'd like to ask Trapper a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com. Use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on our show tonight. Okay, so a couple other questions we've got here. One of the questions was, did you hire qualified guides, or were they more just kind of for the transportation to get you out to the reef?
That's a great question. There are no guides there, you know, which is like many destinations that I go to. And I always think that, you know, if you can find a local, you know, a local fisherman, you're probably going to get an exceptional product because they don't approach the day with any preconceived plans or, you know, expectations from clients or anything like that. They're fishermen. So they know the sea. They know the nuances of the tides and all this stuff. So, you know, we were literally trying, you know, it was difficult, but we were using the resort's dive boat, you know, for a lot of our exploratory because of its hull design and whatnot, and being out in bigger blue water and chasing down the pelagic species and with that. But we'd also go out with some of the local guys in their pongas, and that's also in the video. It'll give you a very good idea of what it's like. So, you know, we hire those guys for the day and take them out. And, of course, you know, it's strange and frightening to them when they see what we're doing, and it's hard for them to grasp, but they catch on fast. But, you know, some, you know, destinations are just, I think, better suited for going out, you know, with someone that is just going to take you to where the fish are. You know, it works out really well.
Okay, so, yeah, so the guides didn't know anything about fly fishing, I take it.
Most of them have never seen it before. You know, they might have seen it on television. It's not like, you know, Micronesia is some, you know, it's not like it's on another planet. They're actually, you know, kind of very well connected to the United States. A lot of what happens in Micronesia is actually funded by the United States. As a matter of fact, you can be driving through the island and see a Social Security office, you know, which is really funny. It's our tax dollars at work over there. But, these guys, you know, and a lot of them kind of think, you know, they see your equipment and they, you know, they look at the flyer and they think there's no way in heck you're going to, you know, land a tuna on that thing or a marlin. And, you know, I think it kind of is a pleasant surprise to them when they see how we do it, you know, which is kind of fun.
And so you had mentioned before pongas. That's the kind of boat you ended up in when you were actually fishing?
Yeah, absolutely. That's what they see. Pongas, you know, they're kind of a universal boat, really. You see them all over Central America. You find them in Africa. You find them in the South Pacific. And really, Ponga is a Japanese-designed boat, I believe. But the word Ponga is an African word, as I believe, if I'm getting my story correct, which is like a blade, means like a blade or something. But so that style of boat is so functional, you know, and so utilitarian. I mean, they are the taxis of the sea. You know, they can haul 2 tons of oranges. They can haul 4 fly fishermen, they can haul entire families. You know, they're like the minivans, you know, of the ocean. And you find them all over the place. And they're great for fly fishing because, you know, they've got a kind of a deep V and they've got the high gunnels, you know, and a lot of them have platforms built into the bow, which for whatever purposes, for transporting people, but it translates really well into fly fishing. So, you know, when we get excited, you know, I really get excited when I, you know, hit a local dock and you see some pongas in there because you know you're going to get a pretty steady platform to to fly fish off of and also be able to access skinny water or be able to handle the blue deep water as well.
Now, would you rather fish from a, it sounds like you think a ponga is more versatile than a flats boat. Is there a preference?
Yeah, I think it depends on the kind of water you're in. You know, if you're mostly in the backcountry on flats and stuff, say around the Florida Keys and stuff, and you're not crossing a lot of blue water all the time, then I think flats boats are great, you know. But pongas are just, you know, exceptionally versatile.
Yeah, yeah. So did you have to teach them how to position the boat for you to cast? Is that a process you had to go?
The easy part was, you know, just get us, you know, broadside to the reef for the inshore stuff, and that was easy. And I happen to be left-handed, and Paul is right-handed, so you can both be casting off the ends of the boat, you know, into the reef with your flies, and that works really well. But that's basically, you know, just, you know, understandable. They already understand that because, you know, they might be, you know, fishing themselves in the reefs, although we didn't see anybody sport fishing for sure. And then when it comes to the blue water, you know, in terms of boat position, these guys, you're following birds, you know, so when you see the birds, you know that there's, you know, fish down there just busting up the bait, and then you just kind of slide in. These guys are pros at it because, you know, they've got a hand line with these tiny little squid patterns and a little weight. And they go trolling up to these things and then cut the motor, or they slide through the pod of birds and all these, you know, tuna busting and foaming up the water everywhere. And so they understood real well how to get us on top of fish. And then it's pretty easy. I mean, you know, it's pretty easy to, you know, not to make light of it, but it's kind of easy to hook a fish when you've got an acre of foaming water out there and, you know, 5,000 ravenous tuna. You know, you're going to get bit, right? So.
Cool. Sounds exciting. Well, how did you decide? I take it there was no equipment there, so you had to bring everything. How did you decide what to bring? What did you bring? And what flies did you bring?
Well, you know, again, it's, you know, you got to be prepared for any eventuality. And for us,
losing you. Chapter,
sorry,
I'm losing you.
That is so funny. I just had four giant tour buses pull up in this gas station or something. It's hilarious. You should see all these people. Yeah, it's probably, they're probably blocking my signal. That's what it is. Well, you know, knowing that it's going to be basically a saltwater game with the possibility of flat species and then certainly the giant pelagic species, you know, you bring everything from what you're comfortable fishing to flat, say for bonefish, you know, from a 7 to an 8 weight all the way up through the 9s up to 15, you know, for some of the big billfish and giant tuna or whatnot. You know, we certainly hook some of that stuff. Now, landing them, of course, is a different story. But, you know, that's kind of, you just kind of, you know, have a backup plan. And also, you know, traveling with some fair amount of conventional gear. And we're doing that down here in the Yucatan because you can cover the water so much more effectively. If you're in lagoons and stuff that you're unfamiliar with and you're uncertain there's fish there, you know, you can, and let's say the lagoon is, you know, 5 acres. Well, it might take you 4 hours to cover that thoroughly with a fly rod, as where you can sit, you know, in one spot and cover a good portion of it in minutes with a spinning rod, for example. And then once you start
to see what's there, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And then, you know, then you can, you know, if you're a conventional guy, wonderful. You know, you can go and continue on. Or, and what we often, you know, invariably do is, you know, kind of, you know, get 100%, you know, positive ID that there's fish, and then we attack it with the fly rod.
Yeah, yeah. We got a couple questions on the internet here that came in during the show. I'm going to read both of them because they're similar, and you can address both of them with your answers. David Shull in Dallas, Georgia, and Jim Midyet in Jackson, Tennessee. David asks, what precautions do I need to take as far as packing equipment and flies for custom inspections? Will they allow flies through security? And Jim asks, how difficult it is to travel or fly commercial with fly tackle, and what tips would you have for the fly fishermen?
Well, here's some good intel on that, guys, and thanks for the question. I travel with my rod tubes. Now, I carry a three-piece rod tube, you know, that can hold about, you know, if I pack it correctly, you know, some butts up and some tips down and get a little creative, no tubes, just the socks on them. You know, I can get 6 or 8 fly rods in my three-piece case. Now, the three-piece, your classic, I think maybe a three-piece fly rod tube is maybe 33 inches, something like that. will generally fit in an overhead bin. And I just traveled down here with it, no problem. I just traveled to Micronesia with it. I was just in Argentina a few weeks ago, no problems. So I've never had an issue with having to, you know, check my fly rods. And I always, here's the way I work it, is, you know, I'll take what I use as my boat bag, you know, some kind of waterproof bag. It could be, say, a Sims Dry Creek boat bag. It could be a Patagonia Great Divider, some kind of waterproof, you know, bag that you know you're going to use on your skiff, and you can put sensitive electronics in it, like, you know, video equipment and whatnot. But I take that on the plane with me, and here's how I pack it, is I put a few essentials in there in case your luggage doesn't arrive. So I always keep a couple liters in there, a couple of fly boxes. I still haven't had a problem entering countries with flies. Some countries I've had problems exiting with flies in my carry-on, but that's kind of unusual. It doesn't seem to be any kind of standardization out there, but what I'll do is, you know, put one or two reels in my carry-on bag, you know, and stuff that you absolutely have to have for success. You're already carrying your rods as your second carry-on, and then in your boat bag, put a couple of reels in there. And a lot of the places, you know, going through security are actually familiar. You know, I think they're very used to seeing traveling fly fishermen now. You know, as where, you know, maybe a decade or two ago it wasn't as common. But so keep some of that stuff so at least you can get on the water with some flies and one rod and reel, or two rods and reels if your luggage were to get lost. You know, I might pack extra rods in my check-in luggage. But, and then what I do is, you know, I put my photographic equipment and whatnot in there. And then I put my DOP kit in there, my shaving kit, you know, with, you know, your shampoo and toothbrush and all that. And then once I get to my destination, I take that shaving kit out, and then I put in my tool bag, like, say, your Boga grip and your knife, you know, for cutting things, and tools that you know they would take away from you if you were to try to go through security. And it seems to work very, very well for me in that respect. One thing you always remember is bring a pair of nail clippers, you know, and that's just one of those things that always gets overlooked, and it's more so for your, you know, personal use for your fingernails, because you're going to get all, you know, banged up out there in the salt. But, you know, just those little tricks seem to really help out. But I haven't had much issue at all in just about anywhere I've gone with traveling with flies and reels and rods.
You know, you mentioned fingernail clippers. I was in Barcelona, Spain, visiting parents of a daughter who was an exchange student with us here in the States. And so we were visiting them at their home, and I had forgot my nail clippers. And I'm asking them, well, is there a place I can go get a nail clippers? They, for the life, they didn't understand what a nail clippers was, because they used scissors.
Right.
He's like manicure scissors, and they never used a nail clipper.
Isn't that...
And then we stopped at some garage sale, and somebody had some nail clippers.
Wow.
And I go, there, that's what I want. That's what I want at bottom of the garage sale. Anyway, it was just kind of a side note. Like, yeah, that, you'd think that was a no-brainer, nail clippers, but sometimes they can be hard to come by.
Yes. It's funny the things you learn through experience.
Yeah. We need to take another quick break, but when we come back, we're going to talk about the fish you caught out there, and you can tell us all about that part of your adventure. So stay tuned. Keeney's Fly Shop in Sacramento, California features classes on all aspects of fly fishing. They have an extensive inventory and fly tying department and a friendly, experienced staff whose primary goal is your complete satisfaction. Among their many services, one can book private waters or take advantage of their international travel service. Visit their extensive website at www.keeney.com. That's K-I-E-N-E.com. Or you can call Keeney's Fly Shop at 1-800-400-0359. That's 1-800-400-0359. Well, you're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Trapper Rudd about fly fishing in Micronesia. If you'd like to ask Trapper a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Okay, the fish. Tell us about the fish. You mentioned tarpon and bones, and Rod in Amarillo, Texas wants to know, did you actually find any bones? Did you fish any bones?
We did not, and it was a crushing blow. I was very, very hopeful. We thought we spotted some one morning on the flat, but it turned out to be some sort of a wrasse that actually looked kind of similar. But that was disappointing. And also the Indo-Pacific tarpon were there. And we actually bumped a couple here and there. They were very small, you know, about maybe 18 inches long. Because one of the coolest things about Micronesia in Kashrai, for example, not Micronesia, but in Kashrai, was they have these wonderful tidal lagoons that are almost like a traditional lagoon like you'd find right here in the Yucatan, for example. But they do get this great flow through them. And so, you know, we got very excited about the fact that the tarpon might be in there. And the unfortunate occurrence was the rain. You know, we ended up with just days of rain that, you know, once it gets into those high volcanic peaks, you know, and starts coming down through the creeks and entering these lagoons, you know, it just really, it turned everything to mocha. So we tried our best. You know, we even did a little night fishing for the tarpon, because it's, when you put on a headlamp, for example, with a red light on it, or a white light too will work, but red seems to be less spooky to the fish, you know, tarpons, their eyes will light up as red dots, and it's kind of like tracking a fish on a video game. It's very exciting stuff. So we bumped a couple here and there. It turned out to be, it was going to be not part of the story, but we were very disappointed not to find bonefish there.
Another question, since you talked about areas of the island, David in Dallas, Georgia, asks over the internet, what part of that island did you fish? You mentioned Tupol. Is it mainly in that lagoon area, or did you fish other parts of the island?
We fished the entire perimeter of the area. Yeah. We were, you know, it doesn't take too terribly long to actually motor around that island. But you can
How big is that island?
I want to say it's about 42 square kilometers. So it's not very big. And, you know, it's surrounded by, you know, it's basically a volcanic peak, and it's just got tremendous, tremendous, you know, reef inshore fishing and blue water fishing, and that really saved the day for us.
We also got two questions in on the internet, one from Lane in California and one from Rick in Maple Glen, Pennsylvania. They're both asking, was there any freshwater fishing there?
Yeah, there was. There's a couple species of fish that they're very small, and they also have freshwater shrimp, these giant shrimp that live in the rivers up there, but everything is so steep. You know, that was the real problem. It's kind of like trying to fish, you know, Niagara. You know, I mean, everything comes down out of those mountains. It, you know, yeah. It plays hell on your drift, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, that's just... Okay, so what species did you catch? And tell us about them.
Well, on a daily occurrence, we would get into the bonita, and they were just everywhere. I mean, as thick as thieves out there. And then the cool thing about it was the yellowfin would come in with them, so you never really knew what you were going to catch. There was a couple times where we busted off some flies and just about lost all of our line on some fish. So we spent a little bit of time. I'm not very strong in the conventional side of fishing, but I'm trying to learn a little bit more about it. So I'm sure I made some rigging errors. But, you know, we would be trolling these Rapala, the company, I think some folks pronounce it Rapala or Rapala, sponsored us as well with a ton of gear to kind of demo over there. And we used a bunch of these kind of deep diving plugs as well. And there was a couple times where we hooked some creatures from the deep that we didn't have a prayer to land, and they must have been just massive. But, you know, so every day we could plan on lots of, you know, skipjack and bonita and yellowfin tuna, and then wahoo. And, you know, if you've ever caught wahoo on the fly, it's an absolute riot. They're fast, you know, their initial streak is just one of the best blistering runs you can ever experience. And if you really want to, you know, shake hands and be friends with your backing, you know, hook a nice wahoo, you know, and you'll see how fast it can come off of a reel. Just keep your knuckles out of the way and keep it away from your clothes, because it'll, you know, your reel going that fast will suck up your shirt and stop that thing dead in its tracks in a heartbeat. It's pretty cool, you know, watching those wahoo, because, you know, they can get aerial sometimes, and they're just beautifully vibrant when they come out of the water. Their colors are just gorgeous. So, and you got to use wire on them, you know, because they'll just saw right through anything else, you know, other than wire. But, you know, we also caught some unusual fish that most people don't get to experience, and one was the locals called a qual rong rong. And the best thing
that
well, it's K-W-A-L R-O-N-G, R-O-N-G, Qual Rong Rong. And I'm sure it's just a Kosh Ryan word for big-ass yellow snapper. I mean, it was...
That's easier to say.
Yeah. Well, I hope I didn't offend anybody listening with my vernacular there, but...
If they've been fishing, they've heard a lot worse.
Yeah, I figure, you know, kind of like sailors, you know. But okay. It was I'd never hooked one. You know, I think the closest thing I could ever have compared this fish to was a Kubera snapper, and it just absolutely nearly, you know, just cleaned my clock and, you know, was going to, you know, beat me to death. This thing was just power, sheer, raw, unadulterated power. It was incredible. What a fish. And the giant trevally are the same way. They're just absolute brutes. You know, just another species that very aggressive. You know, they're just eaters. They don't just eat your fly. They murder it. You know, they're really a great, great target to get on a fly rod. And I certainly would encourage anybody with the opportunity, you know, to get to some water where they have GTs, Seychelles or, you know, Guam, all these islands around that area are going to have giant trevally in the Pacific over there. Boy, they can get absolutely massive as well, you know, 130 centimeters, you know, over 100 pounds in some cases. And they're just, and they eat, you know, that's the nicest thing about them. They're not too terribly finicky. That fly is moving, and especially if you have one that's going to be making some noise or pushing some water like a popper of some sort, you're going to find some trevally. And most of the trevally are like that. You know, it's part of the, if I'm not mistaken, it's part of the jack family, and they are just ravenous. Great, great species to hook up.
Okay, so we got bonita, yellowfin, wahoo, giant trevally, and qual rong rong. What else
right.
did you catch?
You know, it was kind of out of season for the Dorado. They are there, and, you know, the weather, you know, being as poor as it was initially, we were hoping, you know, would push a lot of debris, you know, out into the sea. And, you know, then, you know, with the debris, we should find Dorado. We were just kind of on the cusp, you know, where they weren't really in yet, so we didn't get to target any Dorado or
they're there.
Dolphin, yeah, for, you know, they're also called dolphin and mahi-mahi, I guess, the more common names. And then there's also the pelagics, you know, you have some incredible marlin there and sailfish. And we hooked up one marlin and had it on for about 0.3 seconds before, you know, before it came out of the water with a beautiful aerial display. And, you know, the fish went one way, and unfortunately the fly came back in our faces. But
well, you got the fly back.
Yeah, well, you know.
I remember down, in fact, it was in just off the coast where you are now. I was on a sailboat with some friends and just trolling with conventional gear. I think I had 50-pound test mono on there or something. And something just grabbed that line, never saw it, just went out and just popped that line like it was nothing. And
yeah.
Like I said before, you wonder, what the hell was that? That was so big that it could just pop the line like it was a piece of thread, you know?
Yeah, and, it really, you realize how undergunned you are in those situations.
Yeah, and you don't know, yeah, what you hooked into, you know? Well, good. Yeah. Sounds like you had some great fishing. Now, did you fish for most of them with kind of, you know, just stripping in, you know, targeting an area and stripping in?
Yeah,
or did you use
absolutely.
Sinking lines?
You know, I try not to use sinking lines. You know what? It's very helpful with the tuna and stuff. They're tiresome to throw, especially when you're really into the fish, but, you know, they're very effective. But a lot of times I think, you know, 90% of the situations, you can really cover these fish with a floating line. And I think we were fortunate, you know, the fact that, you know, there was just so much activity going on that, you know, and they were all, you know, pushing bait up to the surface that we really didn't need to go to the sinking lines. We always have those rods, you know, rigged and ready to go deep. But, you know, to me, you know, the pinnacle of the sport is sight fishing. And if you can see your target, you know, I think your sense of accomplishment and your pleasure goes up, you know, tenfold when you can see your fish and target it. And in many cases, you know, our fish was, you know, an acre of fish, but, you know, it's just the visuals that come out of that are so, you know, appealing, and that's really, you know, the attraction, I think, of fly fishing. You know, it's kind of similar to the dry fly take, you know. I think it's more appealing, you know, for me personally than it is to, say, go nymphing, but, you know, it's a lot of personal preference as well.
What was the longest boat ride you had to take when you were there to get to a destination?
Well, you know, there was an island, you know, that was about 170 miles away, and we knew that it just wasn't going to be an option because the resources to get there, you know, we'd have to carry so much fuel to get there and then probably wouldn't find the fuel to be able to return, you know, would cause distress to my family. But, you know, it was, you know, circumnavigating the island, you know, is a, can be, you know, a little laborious, but it was, you know, if the weather's, you know, inclement. But we were very fortunate. I think once the rains came and went, you know, everything got quite tranquil, and we were lucky. We didn't get beat up too bad out there at all.
But, I mean, was it a 30-minute boat ride to get to a...
Oh, God, no. I apologize. No, it was... You know, once we left the dock, we were literally fishing within 5 minutes. Yeah, it was, you're right out, you just go straight out and you're right on the reef. And if you're, like, in the big cuts where you would come into the marina, oh, my God, you know, there's just, you'd see buoys, you know, mooring buoys out there for, say, a dive site or, you know, for large ships, and you might see trevally just, you know, hovering down that line underneath the mooring ball. And amazing sight to see. And you can just start chucking your fly right at it. And you got a great target to shoot at. You know, that big mooring ball is perfect. And then start stripping your fly through there and something's going to come up and eat it.
So did you go out each day targeting a specific species, or did you kind of let these fishermen point you towards what was happening?
Well, I think we targeted with a sense of we knew when we were going to be on the reef, you know, or casting to the reefs, that it was going to be trevallyville, you know, would find lots of trevally. And some fish that we just can't identify, you know, we're just not familiar enough with all the hundreds of species of these coral, you know, dwelling fish that are not seen in other waters. So we knew kind of what to expect in that sense, and it took us, you know, a little bit of time to kind of get our groove together where we kind of knew what to expect and what to go for. And then when we shifted gears to say, all right, let's, you know, we've burned up this side, you know, it's a little blue water stuff, and then we kind of knew what to expect there as well. You know, and a lot of it comes from visiting a local fish market and seeing what they're selling and what they're trading and what's in the freezer.
Yeah,
and that's a great indicator of what you can really, you know, prepare yourself for.
Especially when you don't know the local name of the fish, you can just point and say, take me to these, huh?
Yeah, you know, the perfect example was, you know, I was over in Indonesia when the tsunami hit, and we were looking for bonefish over there, and we found them. And it took us a long time to get the correct fish identified to the locals so they knew what we were looking for. For example, what we did was we knew we were going to run into a language barrier, you know, because they all speak different dialects of Malay over there. And we took magazines with us, you know, and we'd show them pictures of the fish we wanted to target in the magazine. And then they'd go, they'd see a bonefish, for example, you know, the picture that we'd show them. And they'd go, oh, yes, ikan bandan. You know, and we figured out, okay. You know, the Indonesian word for bonefish is ikan bandan. And then everywhere we went, you know, we'd get information about where we might find, you know, the bonefish. And it worked out really well.
Yeah, yeah. Now, did most of the strategies and techniques that you've used in other parts of the world for the salt work there, or did you develop any new techniques?
Nothing too radical. You know, I think, you know, if you're mildly familiar with salt water, you know, certain tricks can certainly help save the day. You know, rigging is one area where it can get very elaborate. I personally try to keep things very, very simple. You know, I'm not the kind of guy that's going for world records and never have been, and so, you know, I don't necessarily care about having a certain class tippet with a certain length of bite tippet and everything else to try to land fish. You know, when you're on an exploratory, you're trying to, you know, get them in, you know, so you can identify them and you got something to say, all right, we can continue doing this and that. So I tend to keep stuff like that fairly simple, and because I think, you know, the more connections and knots that you have, the more opportunity you have for failure. The other side of that is, you know, you got to be careful because you want to make sure there's some weak link in there so you don't lose everything. But
yeah,
keeping your rod tip low to the water or in the water while you're stripping is very important. And then when you're strip striking, you know, just hit them hard and then hit them again and hit them again, depending on what kind of fish you have on, and especially if they're jumpers, and then, you know, clearing your line once they're taking off, you know. So remove your watch, for example, because invariably your fly line will, you know, jump up off the deck and wrap onto your watch band or around your watch bezel, and, you know, you're going to pop the fish off. So, you know, nothing too revolutionary in terms of technique. You know, we took with us experiences that we have in other saltwater destinations and just applied it to these, you know, some of the more familiar fish in just a different ocean.
Now, would you go back to Micronesia?
Oh, in a heartbeat. Yeah, okay. In a heartbeat. You know, see, part of the experience is the culture. You know, it's the people. And really the whole, like any trip, this one I'm on, for example, right now, you know, it's about being a chameleon, you know, blending in with the locals and kind of embracing their culture, trying new things, and just, you know, opening your eyes to the sights and sounds and smells of where you're at. And I think that's, instead of just trying to go out there and conquer fish, you know, if you kind of step into it as, hey, I want to blend in and embrace this community and these people, then you're going to have, I think, a much richer, deeper experience. And that's, for me, that's really one of the most important aspects of it is, you know, is getting to know how these people work and think and how they fish, you know, watching how the local guys do it. I mean, there were guys, you know, that would take hand lines and what we call Cuban yo-yos. I'm sure many of the listeners are familiar with that. It's just like a giant wooden wheel that you can wrap line on. And they would go out and stand on a reef with a chunk of octopus or a whole octopus, and they would just wing this thing out there with incredible skill, and they would land 65-pound giant trevally by hand. I mean, to see stuff like that and hear these stories about their successes, it's just, oh, gosh, you know, it's awe-inspiring.
Well, unless you want to add to that, I think the question I was saving for last here was from Phil Stein in Fargo, North Dakota. He said, what kind of interesting people did you meet while in Micronesia? Anyone that stands out and why? Unless you want to add to it, I think you just answered his question.
Yeah, that's a great
you want to close with any other interesting, you know, comments?
You know, how neat is it to get in, say, this kind of classic, iconic image of a Polynesian outrigger and go fishing, you know, which we did, and the colors, you know, to go to a place where people actually wear leis, you know, around their heads with the fragrant, you know, made out of these flowers. And it's just, you know, it's really neat to really step outside your comfort zone and learn about, you know, all these wonderful people and cultures. I can't say enough about it.
Yeah,
we met some pretty interesting folks, and, you know, the stories that come out of it are, you know, we'll have to save for a novel in the future, but it's, gosh, oh, man, the characters, you can't believe it. It's just amazing, you know, in the how they live and the things that they do. It's pretty interesting, no doubt about it.
Oh, great, great. Sounds like you had a wonderful trip. Well, we need to tie things up here and close things out. Now, we've run out of time, but stick with me here, Trapper, because we're going to give away some great prizes tonight, and I need you to help me verify that people give me the right answer for our great
wonderful
prize here. So hang with me. We've got a few more things to cover, and we'll give away these gifts. The Bristol Bay region of southwest Alaska is home to the largest runs of wild salmon on the planet and some of the best trophy rainbow trout fishing anywhere. The Pebble Mine still remains a threat to the region, and 2 million acres of federal lands may be at risk. The entire fly fishing industry is united in this epic conservation battle. Anglers from across the country are joining the fight. Be one of them. Visit www.savebristolbay.org. www.savebristolbay.org to learn more about how you can get involved. And as a side note to that little public service announcement, the latest, or this month's edition of National Geographic, did a whole story on this, and very interesting, lots of pictures. So if it made National Geographic, you know this is a big, big deal. So you might want to read that article as well. Just a reminder to everyone, before you leave the website tonight, please take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You can find a link on our homepage for the section under tonight's show that says, what did you think of the show? Just click on that link and leave your comments. We'd really appreciate it. Well, now it's time to give away our prizes, and the winners for these prizes are from drawings which we randomly select from our registration database. And if you didn't register yet, it's too late now, but make sure that so you don't miss out on any of our future prizes that we give away. So the first drawing we're going to do is for 1 year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers, 1 year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers, and a great organization to support and be a member of. If you want to find out more about the Federation, go to fedflyfishers.org. That's fedflyfishers.org. And our winner there is Len Hoskin. Len Hoskin in the United Kingdom, so in the UK over there. Great, Len. Congratulations.
Congratulations, Len.
Yeah, and the Federation is an international organization, so they'll be happy to extend that membership to you over there in the UK. So, and then our second prize is some 1 year subscription to Fly Fusion magazine. To learn more about Fly Fusion magazine, you can go to flyfusionmag.com. That's flyfusionmag.com. And again, a wonderful magazine out of Calgary, Canada. Great photographs, great how-to articles, and so forth. And our winner there is Joseph Wall. Joseph Wall from Tasmania, United States. Okay, I hope you're real there, Joseph, but we'll email you and find out. I don't know where Tasmania, United States is, but maybe it's a typo. So anyway, Joseph, congratulations. You get that magazine, and I know you'll enjoy that. Well, now, what we've got to do here is clear my queue. And Trapper, we're, just a second, get that clear. Okay. What we're going to do here for this question that I'm going to ask them to see how well they've been paying attention, and this is only for the people that are live on the show, we're going to be giving away a pair of Rail Riders Extreme Adventure Pants, courtesy of Rail Riders. And these are the toughest pair of fly fishing pants on the planet. Lightweight, synthetic, with super tough reinforced seat knees, good pocket design, and articulated knees. Velcro and elastic cuffs are invaluable for staying put under waders and also prove to be the best wading pants on the market. So these are outstanding pants. I own a couple of pair myself, and they are just rugged, rugged pants. So the winner of this is going to be pleasantly surprised when they open the box they get in the mail. Now, the question is, Trapper mentioned 5 different kinds of fish that they were able to catch on the fly in Micronesia. Name 3 of them. Okay? Out of the 5, name any 3 of the 5 fish that they targeted and caught in Micronesia. Okay?
Very clear.
So we'll see who is paying attention there. Who wants a great pair of pants that you can use for just about anything?
Yeah, do you think you could airdrop a pair of those to me down here? I've been whacked.
I'm sure John at Rail Riders would be happy to do that. So we'll get you guys connected. You'd probably love them down there. Oh, I think Treg Owings in Moscow has it covered here. Let me read this back to you. His answer is Bonita Yellowfin, Blue Trevally, Wahoo, Kual Rong Rong, Big Ass Yellow Snapper. And then he listed several others there. So should we give it to him?
That's a 100% yes.
Okay, so, Drag, yeah, I think you were probably anticipating that question, but good for you because you just got yourself a really nice pair of pants. So, Craig, be sure you send me your contact information, your address, phone number, email address, either in the same text box you did or send it to info@askaboutflyfishing.com, info@askaboutflyfishing.com, and I'll get you connected to Rail Riders so you can get your pants. So congratulations, a great prize to win. Well, Trapper, hey, I really appreciate you being with us tonight and for the little jungle journey you took to get to the cell tower to make it happen, and hey, we got lucky, you know?
Yeah.
Fishing ought to be good tomorrow.
I think it's going to be. I think the rain is passing, and tomorrow we go to chase permit, I believe, so.
Oh, good. I hear you're pretty good at that.
It's my favorite. Well, boy. That's it.
No brag, just facts, huh?
Yeah, well, there might be, you know, a few mishaps in there I could, you know, omit. But
you do good at it. Come on, fess up. You do good at it. So.
Yeah, I try. It's a learning experience.
Right. Well, thanks again, and good luck down there, and be safe, all right?
Thank you, Roger, and thank you for all the listeners tuning in. I hope you enjoyed it, and it was my pleasure.
Great, great. Well, our next broadcast will be on January 5th, 7 p.m. Mountain, 9 p.m. Eastern. And on that show, we'll interview Greg Thomas, and our topic for the show will be fly fishing for steelhead on Queen Charlotte Islands and the Dean River. Greg Thomas pursues wild steelhead in out-of-the-way places with a focus on British Columbia. Recently, he's fished the Queen Charlotte Islands and central British Columbia coast. In July, he lucked into the best week in 10 years on the Dean River and had 17 fish to the beach in 3 days. Listen to Greg's adventures, and you'll learn how to reach these unique fisheries where 10 to 20-pound wild steelhead can be found, often in good numbers. We would like to thank the Federation of Fly Fishers, Fly Fusion Magazine, Rail Riders, Keeney's Fly Shop, and Flats Time Charters for sponsoring our show tonight. If you think your company would benefit from sponsoring one of our shows, give us a call at 1-800-985-1673, extension 8. That's 1-800-985-1673, extension 8. We'll be happy to explain the options available to you. Don't forget to visit our website, askaboutflyfishing.com, and make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.